you descended recently, and you're showing obviously your inflation outlook here a little bit. Did you use the PC inflation here because that's the easiest to communicate, or is it indeed what you're looking at to set your own inflation target? Or differently phrased, what is your favorite way of gauging future inflation expectations? Because of your statement, we referenced certain things, and then how does that contrast with your colleagues? That would be great.
Well, the contrast to my colleagues, I'll refer you to their remarks. One of the benefits of Fed transparency is that it's very easy to ascertain what my colleagues think on various issues. In terms of my own views, though, to talk about that. So the personal consumption expenditure inflation rate, the PCE inflation rate, that's what the FOMC has agreed is the way we're gonna target inflation. So we target a 2% inflation rate in terms of that. The consumer price index is it tends to run a little higher than that, maybe about 0.3% higher than that, just because of the way the composition of goods and services within that. But this is what we target. And you ask about how I formulate my expectations. You know, I try to use a variety of methods, as I think is appropriate, statistical models of various kinds. In my dissent last week, more than that, at the end of October, the FOMC met, and the action the committee took at that time was to reduce the flow of asset purchases. The committee was buying long-term assets at a rate of $15 billion a month, and the committee took the step of reducing that down to zero. I dissented from that decision, because I saw inflation remaining low, but also there were market-based measures of inflation expectations that had moved downward significantly, materially, in my view. And so what do I mean by market-based measures of inflation expectations? Basically, are financial instruments that are out there that allow you to back out what financial market participants are thinking about future inflation. For example, the Treasury issues two kinds of bonds: Treasury inflation-protected securities, which are indexed to inflation in terms of payoff, and then bonds that are not. The difference in yields between those gives you a window into what market participants are thinking about inflation is going to be, because that tells you how much they're demanding in return for because of inflation. What we've seen recently is even longer-term inflation market-based measures of inflation expectations, so you can back out what people are looking at in terms of 2019 to 2024, 5 years to 10 years out. Those have slipped. And so I think that I was concerned that that indicated a lack of confidence or in the credibility of our commitment to this 2% target I mentioned, that people might be thinking we're actually willing to live with something less than that, and I thought we should take a step to address that.
I'm glad you mentioned the inflation expectations, because I told my class, I said, "Here's what the inflation expectations according to the market is over the next, over longer term," and it starts with a two. It's relatively low for 30 years out. But what is interesting about his question was, how do you form expectations? Everyone else in this room can form expectations and then act on them. You actually can affect them somewhat differently than the rest of us. So your expectations may be different about, you know, based on what you do as opposed to the rest of us.
You know, it's the I think it's this is a really important point, Greg, that, you know, I don't from the point of view of a monetary policymaker, inflation expectations are not some autonomous object that just moves by itself. We have the ability, as you say, through our actions, through our communications, to influence those expectations. And I was concerned that by reducing our flow of asset purchases at a time when market-based measures are coming down, and the picture looks like this for inflation, we're not providing the kind of support we needed to for inflation expectations.
Great. I think we have a question over here.
My name's Matt Barger. I was curious how much of your thinking is affected by the impact of the Fed on financial markets and concerns about things like asset bubbles.
So I've given a number of speeches over the past year and a half, I guess, about this topic. And I think it's something that we have to keep in mind, that the way I think about this is we've been given a dual mandate by Congress, which is to promote price stability and max employment. And But I think we've seen, unfortunately, in the events of the past 7 years, that financial instability can cause risks to our ability to achieve those mandated goals. And so I think we have to take account of those risks when we're formulating monetary policy. What does that mean? So I think the problem is it's challenging to know what that means. So you'll hear a lot of suggestions that low interest rates are stimulating a search for yield that might be destabilizing. And there's an argument made to we should raise. Some people have suggested we should be increasing interest rates as a result of that. We try to monitor that very closely in the Fed. You know, how much are we seeing of that kind of behavior? How much is that going to be? And the question I ask myself is, what kind of risk is that creating for my forecast to inflation and unemployment? Right now, at this point, I don't think those risks are sufficiently material to influence my decision making about monetary policy. But as we move forward in time, I think this is something we have to keep our eye on. The thing I would say is that relative to, say, 2005, 9 years ago, our thinking on this, our monitoring, the work that goes on at the system level is just much more advanced. And so I think we have a much better, I'm not going to try to claim it's perfect by any means, but I think we have a much better feel for these kinds of potential sources of instability than we would have in 2005.
Another question over there. Wait for the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wonder, with regard to your inflation targets, what do you do about the strength of the dollar or the lack thereof? It seems like it would be outside your control.
You know, the dollar is in the U.S. System. The dollar is the purview of the Department of the Treasury and not in the Federal Reserve. Certainly our decisions, when we think about the modeling of our decisions, it goes through a variety of mechanisms, and one is through the dollar, but it's through a variety of other mechanisms as well. But yeah, the value, the decision making about the value of the dollar, such as at the governmental level, is in the purview of the Treasury.
One in the back, and then we'll come to the front over here.
To give you a perspective on the parking lot, this was also, and to date me, where the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Tactical Squad used to come to make sure that we Stanford students behaved ourselves. And this sort of leads into a question, and it's more on the fiscal side than the monetary side. Given the enormous disparity of wealth, maybe not experienced in North Dakota or Silicon Valley, what's your sense as an economist as to how that might get reconciled without having significant trouble?
This is a great question about that I think is receiving a lot of attention. I think the best I can, first of all, it's just a question about that I think Americans should be thinking about. It's a very important question to be thinking about is about the distribution of wealth. I think it's important to have the right kinds of facts at our disposal when we do that. And so one of the things we've done at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis to contribute to that is our annual report essay that was done in 2013 looks at the distribution of income before and after tax and transfers. Looking more at the bottom of the income distribution as opposed to the top. So a lot of the conversation you hear about is the top 1%, how are they doing, or the top 0.1%. Our essay focuses more on the median, so the middle of the income distribution relative to the bottom quartile or so. And I think one of the main takeaways from that is you see a growth in income inequality there, and that you can tell a number of stories for that. Probably, I think differences in rates of educational attainment are playing a key role. But after tax and transfers, the increase in inequality is much more diminished. So that's telling you a story where there's been increase in inequality and pre-tax income inequality. This is all the bottom end, though, not so much of what's received the attention at the top. So that's I think the best we can do with the Federal Reserve on this, One of the things we're very good at is we're apolitical and we provide analytics. And that's, I think, the benefit of this essay from the Federal Reserve is on that.
Two questions. One is, what do you think is the danger of the dollar's loss as an international reserve? And the other unrelated question is, you show that the total employment rate is down from about 63% of the population, perhaps 59%. To what factors do you describe that, as opposed to unduly generous welfare benefits or a change in the thinking of the labor force?
So let me talk about the second question first, about the decline in the employment population ratio. I think that there's probably a number of different possibilities underlying that. Some of the causes, though, that people point to as being structural in nature would be things that would reduce the supply of labor, reduce the willingness of people to work. And the way that should manifest itself is upward push pressure on wages. If you didn't have as many people willing to work, and that's what was causing the decrease in the employment population ratio, you should see upward pressure on wages, and therefore it threw on it to inflation. I haven't shown you any wage data, but if I showed you wage growth data, it would look very underwhelming. So you just don't see that being the heart of the matter. What's my takeaway from this? We have insufficient demand for goods and services in this country to utilize the human resources that are available to our country. Don't have enough demand for goods and services. And that's what that inflation number is telling you. If that was closer to 2%, then we could have more of a conversation about what are the supply factors going on. If you look at these numbers, to me, tell me that the demand is playing a major role. On the reserve currency, I over the time horizon that I think about monetary policy, the next year to 3 years out, I don't think this is a material issue for us. Going forward, I think this is going to depend on good decision making by a wide variety of policymakers, not just the Federal Reserve.
I think we have time for one more question, then Narayan has got to catch an airplane. John, do you want to? Rosanna, can you get John Gunn?
Sure.
Let's just assume.
Let's just assume that it's sort of obvious to the most casual of observer, wage rates are going up, whatever, that we should raise interest rates. How do you do that?
How do we raise interest rates?
Yeah.
So right now, I'm trying to think about, I could teach a course on this, so I want to be... Probably Daryl
well,
does
ask the right
a course
person
on
then.
This. Yeah, but let me. I'll try to get think about the right concise answer. The concise answer to this is
your plane has been delayed, so you do have time.
the concise answer to this is that we pay interest on excess reserves to depository institutions, to banks, and if we raise those interest on excess reserves, that's going to put upward pressure on interest rates throughout the whole economy, and through arbitrage forces. So that's the way we're going to be raising interest rates now. In the past, this is what I was trying to think through in the way to answer your question, we would have engaged in open market operations and thereby try to influence that would have been our way to influence the interest rates throughout the economy by exchanging one kind of asset for another. But we're not going to be doing that going forward. In the near term, we're going to be raising interest rates on extra reserves.
Foreign banks, if you raise interest rates on excess reserves, does that present any political problem?
Yeah, I'm not a politician. I think about this I'm given a technocratic objective, which is to hit these inflation targets and employment targets.
Great. Thank you very much, Narayan.
Thank you.